Summertime is grilling season. As you fire up that charcoal, give some thought about the science that goes into making the perfect porterhouse. This hour, we're talking steaks, from how grass and corn affect the type of fat cows put on and the amount of omega-3s, to how genetics influence the marbling in a cut of beef. Then there's the taste tests, of course. We'll talk with a guy who sniffs steak aromas for a living. Tough job. Plus, in the thick of this historic Texas drought, we'll look at how cowboys manage the range, not just with lassos and spurs, but with computer models and satellite technology. And finally, the iconic Texas cattle, the Texas Longhorns, the tale of their evolution as told by their DNA. Coming up after this break. Stay with us. Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. It's grilling season in most of the rest of the United States, and we're broadcasting live from San Antonio, Texas, where it's always grilling season out here. And it's also a state where a lot of those steaks come from. Texas has the most beef cattle in the U.S., some 5 million head. And, of course, you've seen them on TV and in the movies, but there is a lot you think you know about beef on the hoof, but you don't. Do you know about the beef technology that goes into producing that perfect porterhouse with just the right tenderness, fat, rich, beefy flavor, cherry red coloring? Boy, I'm getting hungry just talking about it. The point is, it's not as simple as just putting cattle out to pasture. Like most things, the cattle business is high tech these days. In this hour, we're going to be talking about the science of ranching. And we won't be taking your call today, but if you're here in the audience, don't be shy. Please step up to the mics in the auditorium, and we'll take your questions. You can also email us at sciencefriday@gmail.com. That's a new, easier email address, sciencefriday@gmail.com. Or, of course, you can tweet us at SciFry at SCIFRI. And if you want more information, go to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you can leave us join a topic of discussion over there. Let me introduce my guest. Clay Mathis is director of the King Ranch Institute of Ranch Management at Texas A&M University in Kingsville. He's here with us at the Witte Museum in San Antonio, where we're broadcasting from. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Mathis.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. Chris Kurth is an associate professor of meat science in the Animal Science Department of Texas A&M in College Station. He's also here with us at the Witte Museum. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon.
Sarah Favor-Davis is co-owner of Wild Type Ranch in Cameron, Texas. She's also a former professor of genetics at Texas A&M, and she joins us from KAMU. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Favor-Davis.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Let's talk first about the typical cattle ranch in Texas. Clay, there, you know, from the images we have on the old westerns and on TVs, we have cattle ranches that look like the Ponderosa, right? Thousands and thousands of head of cattle. Is that the typical cattle ranch?
Well, there's certainly ranches that are very large in Texas, but there's also a lot of ranches that are much smaller. So we have quite an extreme, from ranches that may have 20 or 30 head to those that have 10,000, 15,000 head.
But what would the average size then be of all these?
In Texas, the average size is probably, if we look at a ranch in terms of beef cow numbers, probably between 30 and 50 head, close to 40.
40 head of cattle. That's what I'm saying. We think that they're all these giant ranches, but they're not. I see you're shaking your head, Chris.
Yes.
This is true.
Yes.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Chris, because I think this is great, because you have part of your job is something we would all like to have, and that is analyzing the aroma of steak.
Yes.
You sniff the steak.
I sniff the steak.
Tell us how that works.
Well, we actually analyze all methods of sensory analysis of meat, and so we don't only get to sniff the steak, we also get to eat the steak, and so it is one of the greatest jobs in the world.
I won't comment on your size, if you have to be a big person to eat the steak or not.
Not at all.
Tell us, but there is a science in the aroma,
yes.
Right? You're doing it more than just to smell the steak.
Yes.
Well, there's a test that you do.
Yes, because many of the other things, we can look at a steak. We have instruments that can measure the color, the tenderness, how much juice there is in it. But flavor and aroma is something very different. It's very difficult to have a machine that can measure that. And so we really have to rely on our own noses. And it's very, very complex. And so now we've kind of taken it to the next level. And many years have used technology to measure the aromas and flavors. And now we're trying to kind of bring that up to the new age and apply it to current technology. In that there are so many different new frontiers in meat in trying to create that better steak. And so we can use this machine to actually separate and individually identify every single chemical compound in that aroma and actually smell each one of those individual compounds to see which one is causing the good aroma and which is causing a bad aroma.
So you put the steak in a jar?
Yes.
And then you put what in there to separate? How do you separate all the different aromas out of it?
Well, it's simply a little fiber that is coated in a coating that absorbs all of the aromas, the volatile compounds that are coming off of that steak. And we let it sit there and absorb those aromas. And then once it does, we put it on this machine, a GC mass spec, which many people have seen on CSI or forensic shows like that.
Mass spectrometer.
Exactly.
And it analyzes all the different little lines show up or something.
Right.
Like
it separates out one big aroma into all of its independent compounds, and we'll identify them specifically, draw a structure for you. And at the same time, we have somebody sitting there smelling those compounds as they're coming off this machine, and so we can identify the exact aroma with what exact chemical compound it is.
And once you know that, how does that help you build a better steak?
Well, then it becomes the chemistry of sensory science. And you go back and you identify these chemical compounds and know that, well, this one is a result of a fat breaking down, or it may be a result of an amino acid from a protein and a sugar combining and being heated. Mm-hmm. And so we know kind of the chemistry of the aromas, and we can backtrack and it is the CSI of beef aroma to find where the culprit is or where the good guy is.
Can you actually package the aroma in a spray can?
Absolutely.
You can?
Yes.
And to spray it on what?
Well, to give you an example, the company that manufactured and designed this particular machine did a segment for Micro and Dirty Jobs where they recreated the odor of Micro's boots. By taking the very specific chemical compounds that were being smelled and combine them and to recreate that aroma. So it's absolutely doable.
Wow. Dr. Faber-Davis, you used to be a genetics professor, and now you have a ranch. So tell us what DNA has to do with raising cattle.
Well, as a geneticist, I'd have to tell you that it has a lot to do. We start with the best genetics and then do our best not to screw them up before they get to the plate.
So you test the DNA of the herd then?
Most of our animals are DNA tested. Enough of our cow herd has been tested now that we only test new bulls coming in or new animals. But we test for marbling, tenderness, docility, longevity, feed efficiency.
So you can do sort of a DNA profile of what makes a good piece of beef on the hoof and know what it is by just testing the DNA of the cattle?
Well, we know a good chunk of it, and then there's a whole lot of experience, and we do our own taste testing as well.
Mm-hmm. And so then if you have new cows or cattle being raised and coming in, do you say, well, from the DNA testing, we know this is not a good candidate to be used as for food, and you don't use that cow or that steer for food?
Well, actually, the DNA testing, we select the best ones to save to breed for the ones that will produce the food next year. The ones mm-hmm. that kind of fall out are the ones we eat this year. So next year's steaks are always better than this year's.
Of course. Of course. That's what we mean by aged beef, right? No. So then instead of visually culling a herd like you would do in, quote, the old days, looking for the cattle, you know, you can do that DNA-wise and saying this is the one we want to breed.
Yes and no. When I started out, I'm such a data geek, and we collected data and had DNA tests and everything. But I learned that those old cattlemen know an awful lot, and sometimes we professors don't know everything. So we use a whole lot of visual appraisal along with the DNA.
Clay,
so there's some things
Clay,
that the DNA still doesn't
you're
tell
you're
us.
You're shaking your head up and down.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we can do a lot of genetic testing, and we can try to understand as much as we can about the genetic makeup. The environment still plays a huge part in how these animals ultimately turn out. There's things that you can tell with genetic tests and things that you can't determine. We can't tell how structurally sound an animal is by a genetic test. So, you know, an animal's got to be able to walk around, it's got to be structurally sound, and those types of things. So visual appraisal is still a major component. We're just learning more and more and more by all the technology and learning about these different genes and describing these traits with those genes. So it's still the same package. We just know more on the variation now than we did before.
Yeah, and speaking of now versus before, what kind of technology do you use now on the modern cattle ranch that they didn't do before? Other technology things?
Well, you know, there's lots of technologies that have been used in the past, like the windmill and how that opened up waters to lands in the West. But there's other technologies. The Internet is used for information all the time. We have the ability to do things with simple things like Excel. We can model some things better than we could in the past. And so we have better decision-making skills because we can interpret more information at one time now. But still, it still comes back to a balance of a lot of complexities at one time to be able to really manage a ranch.
Can you put a GPS tag on the cattle and find out where they're roaming?
Actually, from a research standpoint, that's done quite a lot to discover what's causing some cattle to graze farther away from water sources than others. How well are they using the pastures more uniformly? So there's research done. Now, it's very expensive technology. It's certainly not an application on a normal working ranch, but it does help us get an insight into how these cattle are traveling different ranches.
Because I know they put these electronic chips on potato chips and things like RFI chips and things like that to follow where they've gone. I would imagine that the easy thing to do, possibly with cattle.
Technologically, it's there. It's just very expensive for an application for a ranch.
And I guess if your ranch is only 30, 40, 50 cattle, they're cows or bulls, then that's going to be expensive to sort of do that sort of thing.
Well, that's true, especially one of these units may cost $2,000 to $3,000.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Never mind.
Right.
All right, we're gonna take a break and come back and talk lots more. Don't go away. You hear me on the air every week, but do you know what it's like inside our studios? Yeah, you can check out pictures from the studio every Friday at our Facebook page, facebook.com/scifry. We're talking this hour about all the science that goes into making great steaks. We're here in San Antonio, Texas, with my guests, Clay Mathis, director of the King Ranch Institute of Ranch Management at Texas A&M, Chris Kurth, associate professor of meat science in the animal science department of Texas A&M, and that's in College Station, and Sarah Favor Davis, co-owner of the Wild Type Ranch in Cameron, Texas, also a former professor of genetics at Texas A&M. If you'd like to ask a question, our microphones are open for you in the audience, and we won't be taking any calls on the phones today. Dr. Favor Davis, can you actually tell what genes are in a steak that make the meat tender, or what genes are in the cow that create the tenderness in beef?
The technology that we use for DNA testing is genetic markers. So for the most part, we haven't identified exactly what gene or the mechanism that contributes to whatever trait we're looking at. So we're just kind of looking at these roadmaps, and they're specific to the breed that we're looking in. So we raise primarily Angus and Red Angus, and we know in these, I send my DNA samples off, and the lab tests them and says, you know, these guys have the favorable genes for marbling and not so many good genes for tenderness, or give us a profile across all the traits.
Mm-hmm. Chris Kurth, is there a scientific method besides just feeling the beef with your hands to measure tenderness?
Yeah, absolutely. And we do that, and it's a well-proven technique where really what you do is it's a machine called a shear machine that has a knife on it, roughly the sharpness of a butter knife. and it's attached to a scale that measures how much force it takes to cut through a piece of meat. And obviously, the lower the shear value, then the more tender the piece of meat. So we use that information, we age the meat, and we can, with a machine, get an objective measure of how tough or how tender a piece of meat is.
Very interesting. So it's that simple.
Yes.
It's a butter knife with a weight on
it. In the simplest of terms. And then we use more technological methods to see, why a piece of meat is more tender, because we obviously like to duplicate that. And mm-hmm. So it does go back all the way to the things like the genetic markers and so forth.
Mm-hmm. What are cattle fed on?
Well, on these ranches, cattle eat grass.
Grass-fed steer meat.
Well,
grass.
Cattle eat grass. Also, when we get farther along in the production system, a lot of the times that's when the cattle will move to confinement, and they're hand-fed lots of grains as mm-hmm. well.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And so they spend most of their time just grazing on the grass.
Most of it, yes.
Wow. Because we always see in the movies and TV are these giant feedlots where the cattle are just getting fed.
Well, that's part of the industry. We try to put as much gain on those animals and or allow them to gain as much as we can before they move into that stage of finishing, where we can get the nice grain-fed flavors that come out with grain finishing.
And what is your feeling about putting antibiotics into the food or finishing cattle with that?
Well, when cattle become sick, we certainly need to rely on antibiotics, because it's our job to make sure that they stay healthy, that we can help them recover from that. So that's a really, really important component of treating those sick animals.
But as a preventive, we keep hearing that these antibiotics being put in just to make them bigger, fatter, but that they may not be needed, and then they find their way, and we have these disease-resistant antibiotics, things like that.
Well, there are times, especially with animals when they first arrive, and they're commingled with other animals, so that there's a little bit of stress associated with a move, just like if we were to move from one place to the next. In those times, a lot of the times there will be some low levels of mm. antibiotics that are fed, so that we can avoid the sickness in those animals that might occur otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, any follow-up from you?
Well, I operate in a niche market, so we do direct sales, and we are completely pasture-raised. So our cattle stay on grass all of their life. I'm not adherent to a label, so my environment doesn't allow me to produce choice-grade beef, because I won't cut a steak off an animal that isn't going to grade choice. So we do feed a little bit of grain when our cattle are not gaining enough to give us the choice grade. Mm-hmm. Our stance on antibiotics, again, if we have a sick animal, we will treat that animal, because I'd rather treat the animal than have it suffer or send it to the sale barn because I treated it and it doesn't fit my label. But our stance is, if our environment is causing enough stress to the animals that they respond to a routine antibiotic, then we try to reduce the stress in the environment. So we don't ever use prophylactic antibiotics.
All right, let me go to the questions on our audience here. Yes, go ahead, sir.
Hi, my name is Christopher Brown. I live here in San Antonio, Texas. My question has to deal predominantly with water. Bexar County, and I'm sure most of Texas, is under drought conditions. Bexar County is also under some pretty stringent water restrictions. So I guess my question has to deal with, I was wondering if any of our guests could cover how the cattle industry deals with drought conditions and the extreme amount of water it takes to raise cattle. And also, what is the industry doing as a whole to perhaps reduce the amount of water used to raise cattle and still produce quality beef?
All right, Clay, do you want to answer that first?
Well, sure. The first part of it, with regard to drought, the first thing that happens in a drought is we know that there's not as much forage produced on the rangelands. And so the response to that is you have to find ways to reduce the need for forage. And so you can do that by removing some of the cattle. Maybe you go from or reduce your herd by 20% to respond to that drought. Another option is you could purchase outside feed and try to feed that and reduce the demand of forage. That's also very expensive. So those are some of the things that we try to do to respond to drought, because one of the important things is we certainly don't ever want to ask more from the rangelands than it can give up and overgraze that forage. And people are very conscientious about that stewardship of the land. Mm-hmm. With regard to water needs, water is the lifeblood of ranching. We've got to have water for animals to drink, And so that's critical. They have to always have water. And they do. And they do, because we remove them if we have no water. As far as the efficiency of use of that water, if you look, and especially if you go west of San Antonio, and you look where there's, you see windmills in a lot of places, and you see storage tanks. It used to be that these storage tanks were open-topped. You see much more of these storage tanks where they're closed-topped now. And the closed-top means that we don't have the evaporation, because you can lose a lot of water in evaporation. So there's a tremendous interest in trying to protect that use of water, making sure we don't use more than we need, making sure that we can don't have too much runoff with water and collect some of that water before it runs downstream too fast. Hmm. And I'm talking about small, 5 acres, and you have a little pond. You retain some of that water so it stays in the soil there as well. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of things that we do.
Sarah, how would you deal with this? How would you answer that question?
Very much consistent with what was just said. We have a lot of tanks. We try to maintain the buffer around those tanks, try not to let the cattle get the water tanks too muddy. And for those who don't live in Texas, tanks are ponds. And we have just run piping out because water quality is incredibly important. So we are now piping water down to some of our lower pastures so we can continue to rotate and not overgraze certain parts of our ranch and get the cattle access to the grass the little grass we have. Mm.
Is it possible to change the kind of cattle you have that are more drought resistant, that will survive better? Can you breed better cattle to, if you know that this is, maybe it's climate change, maybe you're going to have 30 years of a drought, or it's going to be drier than it used to be, and you want to survive as a cattleman, bring different cattle in. Chris, I see you're shaking your head on that. Is that possible?
And you see that all over the world where the type of cattle in a particular geographic region are, have adapted themselves or are managed for that geographic region. And so in this part of the country, we see a lot of Brahman cattle that have the big humps because they're very resistant to drought and so forth. So that's a big part of managing the environment is finding the animals that fit the environment.
Mm-hmm. So you might crossbreed the Brahman with a different...
Yes, to get all of the best traits so we can get a little bit of the drought tolerance and mix it in with other quality traits and mothering traits and kind of take the best of all of them.
Is anybody preparing for the fact that this might be a longer range kind of drought, Clay?
Well, this is part of ranching in this part of the world. We know that droughts will come, and then we will have wet years in between, and there will be another drought. It's always on the forefront of a manager's mind of how am I going to respond to the next drought and do it in a cost-effective manner that's going to be good for the land, good for the animals.
Mm-hmm. Go to the gentleman here at the microphone.
Hi, Lamar Sawyer, San Antonio, Texas. What's the most prominent breed of beef cattle in the United States, and have any particular breeds been developed for use in unique environments like Texas?
Hey, you want?
I'd be glad to respond to it. In general, in the United States, if you look at the number of the type of bulls and the breed that has the most bulls that are sold, it's really the Angus breed. But there are lots of different breeds out there, and there's lots of variation within those breeds. The trick is how do you find the right breed or mix of breeds that's going to most efficiently, or have a cow that's going to most efficiently harvest the forage there and produce a calf. And so, that's the focus is trying to find that balance. And it's different in different parts of the country. So there is no perfect breed. It depends on where you are and what matches your environment the best. And then what type of bulls do you breed to those cows to produce the type of quality product that's going to satisfy consumers?
Mm-hmm. Chris, just to get back to talking about grazing with cattle, and we talked about grass-fed and lot-fed. Is there much of a difference when you grass-feed a cow versus the grain-fed beef? Different in the meat that is?
Yes, there's a number of differences that you see in the meat. The first thing is the lean tends to be a little darker. The fat will have a little bit more yellow in it from the carotenes in the forage. The tenderness just tends to be more variable because the forage is not as consistently available, and the same type of forage is not always the same. And the flavor certainly is going to differ because the things that are included in the diet have a direct impact on the things that we have in the portion that we get that aroma from, especially the fats. And so it has a difference in flavor as well.
Can you breed cattle or feed them something that gives them a higher level of, let's say, omega-3 fats?
You can, but it's a little bit more difficult in cattle because they're ruminants, and so their own stomachs tend to make the kind of fats that they need. But we can increase, for instance, omega-3s or CLAs, which are kind of popular in the media these days. But the types of differences that we get really don't have a significant nutritional difference in the amount that we see in the final product.
Mm-hmm. We're broadcasting from the Witte Museum in San Antonio this hour on Science Friday, talking about cattle raising and all kinds of aspects of what it is to be a cattle farmer and things that have to be done in this modern age of high technology on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flato here at the Witte. Let's go to the auditorium. Next guest up there at the mic. Hi.
Thank you. My name is Jennifer Peel, and I am from San Antonio. And although I'm currently a vegetarian, I'm a native Texan, so I grew up eating lots of beef and have a lot of beef-eating friends and family still. So I'm curious, you were talking about the nature versus nurture, obviously with being able to select cattle based on their DNA, but there are lots of other issues about what they're fed. And I'm just curious, is there any evidence to suggest that animals, or specifically cattle that are treated more humanely, actually make for better steaks?
Sarah, do you want to answer that?
Oh, animal welfare is one of the three founding principles of the ranch. When we make a management decision, it's based on product quality, animal welfare, and environmental sustainability, and those aren't independent. So an animal's innate docility affects its meat quality and its ability to grow, and how the animal is handled really, especially close to the time that it's harvested, can have a dramatic impact on product quality.
So you don't want to stress the animal is what you're saying.
That's right. If it has a bad day on the way to the market, you're going to get a bad steak.
That should be on the bumper sticker someplace, I think. A bad day. And so you can. It actually does show up. How does it show up in the steak? When you say a bad steak, what does that mean?
Well, an animal that's stressed very close to the time that it's harvested or slaughtered will have a dark color, and the meat will tend to be drier and tougher. It doesn't age well. You release all of those adrenaline and all those other hormones associated with the flight response, and it negatively impacts the meat quality.
Is that like the old, there was an old saying about milk, you know, the contented cows, milk from contented cows are better? That's the same sort of theory that's going on there? Yeah?
I grew up on a dairy farm, and we got into big trouble if we chased the cows before they were milked.
Clay, did you want to?
Well, I think that it's really important to understand that if we look at the whole beef industry, you know, it's an industry of pride and stewardship. It's pride in how the stewardship of the land, it's stewardship of the livestock, of the wildlife that are associated with that land. And so that's all very, very important. We know that the better we can treat these animals, the better that they're going to perform. And so that's why there's so much focus on the industry and trying to do things in ways that are going to be relatively low stress. And because if we do, these cattle do better. So there's a limit to that, because we can get to the point where it's completely not cost effective. It's an extremely low margin business anyways, where we're looking at really maybe 0 to 1% on average return on investment. Mm-hmm. In these operations. We have to keep that in mind, but animal welfare and the way we take care of these animals is critically important to the industry, and they're very focused on this.
I'm reminded that the recent film about Temple Grandin, Sarah, that showed her work on designing the slaughterhouses to make things less stressful for the cattle. That kind of stuff.
Yeah, and that one for the cattle and one for the slaughterhouse as well.
Mm-hmm. And are people always thinking of new ways to relax the cattle out there? Yeah,
this industry tries every day to find ways to
play music or classical music or anything like that. I mean, I'm sort of semi-serious about that sort of thing. Chris, the cattle react to music, stuff like that?
Well, I don't know specifically about music, but, that's, I think, one of the misconceptions is that you know, there is none, the producers out there have no benefit in having the animals handled or in an environment that is anything but the most humane, because the more relaxed and the more stress-free these animals are, the better production that they have, the more efficient they are, and it's nothing but good comes out of a stress-free environment.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll come back and take more questions to our audience. I want to thank you, Chris Kurth, Texas A&M College Station, and Clay Mathis of Texas A&M Kingsville, for taking time to be with us today. Thank you for talking to us about the cattle industry. We're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more about cattle. We're going to talk about the history of the Texas Longhorn. It's very interesting genetic history of Texas Longhorn, and we'll talk about that when we get back. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Got a hankering for a bit more conversation? You didn't like what you heard. You want to hear more of it? Well, you can keep the chat going at Science Friday's Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/scifry. Or you can tweet us all week long at scifry. That's at SCIFRI. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I am Ira Flatow. Next up, longhorns, one of the most iconic breeds of cattle. You can find them in Texas today. But do you know where they came from? Anybody? You know in the audience where they came from? Yeah? No. See? Educational moment at this time. That's one of the things my next guest is piecing together by studying the tale told by the DNA of the Texas Longhorn. Emily Jane McTavish is a PhD candidate in the Ecology, Evolution, and Behavior Program at the University of Texas at Austin. She's here with us at the Witte Museum in San Antonio. Welcome.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
I just asked this Texas audience where their iconic cattle came from. I had no idea. Can you fill us in the history and the traveling of the Texas Longhorn?
Yeah, I'd love to. Parts of the story are really straightforward, and then what I think are maybe the more interesting parts are more complicated. But as probably most people know, there were no cattle in North America at all prior to Columbus's voyage here. And the first cattle in North America were actually brought by Columbus himself to the Caribbean, to the island of Hispaniola.
On a second voyage?
Yeah, exactly, in 1493. So a long time ago. And that must have been a really challenging voyage, just thinking about the logistics.
How many miles on a boat with those cattle? I'm sure. Wow.
I know it was. They actually made a really good trip on that voyage. It had taken them, I think, close to 60 days the first time, and they made it in 21.
Wow. And how many? How many? Do you have any idea?
No, most of the records have been lost based on what we know the capacity of those ships were. Maybe 20 or 30 on that first voyage. Mm-hmm. And most of those would have been what are called bred heifers, so pregnant females. So you can kind of get more bang for your buck in terms of carrying those animals across.
And they came originally from Spain.
So that's the interesting part of the story. The cattle were probably picked up in the Canary Islands, so an island that Columbus stopped off on that's just off of the west coast of Africa. And we know that Spanish and Portuguese settlers had brought cattle to the Canary Islands probably 15 or 20 years prior to Columbus's voyage. And that would be the most convenient place for him to have gotten cattle on that trip. And we know that cattle in the next few decades were brought from there. So they were probably brought from the Canary Islands and then into the Caribbean. And we do know that the cattle that were brought into the Canary Islands were from Spain and Portugal. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of multi-step process, but they were brought into the Caribbean in 1493, and by early in the 1500s, were doing very well in Mexico.
They were in Mexico, and were they being raised as cattle, or are they roaming around, or what?
Well, it was kind of a combination. In the first years after Columbus brought colonists to the Caribbean, the cattle weren't doing that well. The colonists weren't doing that well. They were supposed to be breeding them, but they were really hungry, and they were eating them a lot of the time.
Eating that breeding.
It took them a while to get that sort of stocks moving forward and breeding cattle. But by the 1520s, there was a very healthy population of cattle throughout the Caribbean islands and into Mexico. And they actually adapted really well and did very well in Mexico with very little hands-on ranching.
So how did they wander north into Texas?
Yeah, I mean, basically both on their own and tracking with people. That's one of the neat things about cattle is by looking at their DNA and tracking their migratory history, you're also tracking the history of the peoples that they're associated with.
So if we took, we have a couple of longhorn outside, if we took their DNA, and I don't know if it's possible to compare it to, you know, the Spanish DNA of their ancestors, would it look very much alike?
So that's where things get really interesting, I think. So we did know that these cattle were brought over by Columbus and Spaniards colonizing this area. But I've been doing research on the DNA of longhorns and comparing it to other breeds of cattle. Interestingly, using a lot of the same markers that the previous panel was talking about using, sort of looking forward for beef production, I'm using to look backwards at evolutionary history, but using that same technology. And so what we've found is that it does seem like these cattle do show that expected Spanish heritage, or sort of Iberian Peninsula, that Spanish and Portuguese heritage. Mm-hmm. But one thing that not a lot of people may know is that cattle weren't just domesticated once. The species that was the wild progenitor of cattle was actually domesticated in two completely separate places around the same time, roughly 8 to 10,000 years ago. So these separate domestication events have led to different lineages of cattle that have quite distinct DNA. And what we were seeing in Texas Longhorns is a signature of this more Indian-like cattle as opposed to European cattle, which is what you would expect from Spanish and Portuguese breeds.
And we were talking about the Indian Brahmin.
Exactly. I thought it tied in so well with what the earlier panel was saying about drought resistance.
So would these cattle be more drought resistant than their ancestors?
Exactly. So this Indian breed, they're called Bos Indicus or Indicus breeds of cattle, are more tropically adapted, and they tend to be more food stress and drought stress adapted. But the flip side of that is that they're not as... they don't put on meat as rapidly, and they're not as efficient dairy cattle.
Have the horns adapted at all over the years?
Yeah, that's a really cool question, because obviously looking at a longhorn, hopefully you guys in the audience here saw the ones that are outside, their horns are crazy.
They're dangerous looking.
Yeah, and they seem almost like they wouldn't be that adaptive.
Yeah. What are they going to keep away with those horns? What enemies are, you know...
Apparently coyotes.
I know dinosaurs around that they're going to attack, you know, coyotes.
Yeah. Apparently. It seems like a lot of firepower for coyotes. But,
I see a coyote goes up to that cattle and says, I'm not taking that guy on, you know, that sort of thing.
Exactly. And it's really surprising if you see them walking through brush or trees or anything, how aware they are of the shape and size of their horns. They look like they just get stuck all the time, but they can use them very delicately.
I'll bet they can. And so you're studying the DNA in these cattle.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you study them? I mean, how can you tell the history of their domestication from the DNA?
So I would say partially.
Yeah.
So what we have are a lot of DNA sequence markers scattered throughout the genome. That's what's cool about new technologies that are being developed. And what's great about working on cattle as opposed to, any sort of, say, chipmunks, any
right.
kind of wild animal, that you don't necessarily have the molecular tools that are being developed related to the beef industry. So I'm able to use these same molecular tools to look at evolutionary questions.
Hmm.
We have markers that are on all 29 of all of the cattle's chromosomes, and that we can use to track history.
So have you become sort of enamored with the Texas Longhorn?
I really have. My background is actually in working on reptiles and amphibians. I used to work on frogs.
That's a jump.
Yeah,
that's a
is.
Stretch.
Yeah, exactly.
Or the horned toad might be.
Exactly.
Sorry, I had a.
It all ties together, but most of my research is done on data that's actually sent to me. I don't get to do a lot of field work with cattle. But my advisor, David Hillis, a professor at the University of Texas, ranches longhorns. And so I get to go out to his ranch and hang out with them sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say that these longhorns are descended from the Spanish cattle. And just this week, I think, the running of the bull started in Pamplona, Spain. Would they be sort of longhorn-looking like these cattle?
Yeah, that's a good question. They are similar looking, and they share Spanish ancestry, but the fighting bulls of Spain are one of the earliest breeds of cattle that were specifically maintained as a breed, as opposed to what's called land races, which is just kind of the group of cattle that are in a place at a time. So although longhorns would be related ancestrally to these fighting bulls of Spain, actually the fighting bulls were brought to Mexico about 50 years after longhorns and kept quite separately.
Did you ever study how, you know, the great cattle drives of the longhorns at all? Is that an interest to you?
Yeah.
How did they begin? I mean, how did all these cows, you see them in the movies, the cowboys. Is there mythology that we think is right but is not, you know? If you had all these cattle roaming around, right, all by themselves, you just go out there and collect them?
I mean, that was the cool thing about ranching in Texas, is that you didn't need to own land, because people who did own land often couldn't afford to fence it. You just had to brand your cattle, and then if there were calves associated with cattle you knew were yours, the next year you'd brand those. If you saw unbranded cattle, you'd grab them and brand them too, and then that's how you knew they were yours. And then, so actually, during the Civil War, a lot of people were were sort of busy outside of Texas. Cattle really became, population numbers became really high, and it was at the end of the Civil War that there were a lot of these big cattle drives bringing cattle north.
So you could, if you just found these longhorns without any brand on them, they're yours for the taking.
Apparently. I think there was a lot of sort of social contract. You know, you knew which were yours and you knew which were your neighbors. That's my understanding of
it. Wow. And do you study other cattle than longhorn also?
I do. I mean, I'm broadly interested. So when I'm talking about longhorns being brought by Columbus, that Spanish New World cattle, there are a lot of breeds that descended from that. So the Corriente cattle of Mexico, a lot of different breeds of Northern South American cattle. And Central American cattle that show the same signature of Spanish ancestry. So I'm interested in all of those and in the patterns that led to what we see here today.
Well, we love your enthusiasm. I mean, it's great to be in. Yeah, you look like you love your job and what you're studying.
I do.
And that's good. And it's good that we have a come to Texas and tell Texans about their own icon.
Yeah.
Because they don't, you know, seem to know much about it. Thank you very much, Emily.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Emily Jane McTavish is a PhD candidate in ecology, evolution, and behavior at the University of Texas at Austin, joining us here at the Wood Museum. Now with us is Flora Lichtman, our video pick of the week, our multimedia editor. Now, Flora has been very busy out there also filming not cattle, but
another local icon. Well, a man, Malcolm Beck, who studies something slightly more unsavory, would say.
Unsavory?
Yeah, although I'm a total convert now. He's a guru of compost.
Compost?
Yes.
A guru of compost.
He has been driving the compost train for 50 years. He started doing compost, this compost business. And if you live in San Antonio, you might know of Gardenville. It sounds like people in the crowd do know about it. So it's a organic farming and gardening center, and he's the guy who started it over 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. And he was an organic farmer, you know, in a time when it wasn't quite as trendy. And he said that when he started his compost business, people hadn't even heard the word.
Mm-hmm. This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flato with Flora Lichtman talking about the king of compost.
That's better. That's about even better than compost guru.
The king of compost. And you went out, it's on our video pick of the week up on our website at sciencefriday.com. You watched these piles of compost and that he collects and he makes.
40 acres of compost processing. These big, giant mounds of, you know, black manure and other stuff.
I couldn't have said it any better or any safer. there's an aha moment in your video, because when you look at these black mounds of manure, and he says his most prized manure comes from what?
This is amazing. From bat guano. That's like the really good stuff. It gets packaged separately. It's the gold standard of compost, apparently. And it's from Bracken Cave here in San Antonio.
Bat guano. And he's got these mounds and mounds of it. But what he won't tell most people is the secret he told you.
Yes.
Hope no one's listening because it's a secret.
But this is the secret life of compost. Here it is. How do you know when compost is done? Because, you know, the basic mixture is carbon, wood chips, and then a manure, a poop source. Let's just say it.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you know it's done? You stick your hand in it, and you take it to your nose, and you take a big sniff. And if it doesn't smell so manure-y, then it's done. He actually said, find a woman because they have a more acute sense of smell. So that, Catherine, our arts producer,
for all the excuses I've heard about find a woman, sniffing bat manure or whatever is got to be delayed. But the thing also about bat manure that he told you is that it's not really bat manure, is it?
Oh, yes. Yeah, so this is the other aha moment. The bat guano fertilizer is actually beetle poop, because it's the beetles that break down this bat guano in this cave, and so that's what they're literally vacuuming out of the cave. Beetle poop is the bat guano manure.
So that's really not even his high quality stuff.
Ira, I feel like you're outing him or something.
No, I think it's really fascinating.
It's amazing.
Absolutely fascinating. And he sells it in bags and people take it away.
Yeah, I think he ships it all over the place. And there are different varieties. In fact, you know, I think the different manure comes from different places. The San Antonio sewer system, for example, the zoo stables. You know what?
Zoo do.
What's
They used to sell zoo. Yeah, they used to have zoo out there from the zoos, yeah.
But it's like a recycling plant. I mean, this guy really is doing an amazing thing. He's taking a lot of garbage and turning it into plant food.
And he'll ship it anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
So he bagged it
check
up.
Check the website.
That's it. Go to our website. It could be a great holiday gift, you know.
Local.
It's local product. You know, it's useful. Really good compost is the best soil in the world. You know, you guys, farmers and ranchers, you put your hands in the great compost, and it really is wonderful stuff. And if you go to our website at sciencefriday.com, you can watch Flora and her visit out there to watch how he processes all this manure and compost.
And if you live in San Antonio, it's definitely worth going to have a look at his place. He's got a test garden. It's a cool operation.
There you go. Now, if you needed something to do for the weekend, you can go out and visit, pick up a bag of it for yourself. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Some of you have asked us, why is it necessary to include ads in these podcasts? It's a good question. The simple answer is we have to find some way to pay for them. NPR does not underwrite our podcasts or any of our social media, like our website or our videos. In fact, they only contribute 10% of our total budget. So instead of charging you for this podcast, we put in a couple of ads. If you'd like to help close that deficit, please go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the support button and donate a few bucks. Thanks.